Welcome to our fifth Sonic session for the University of Brighton course, Media and Popular Culture. I'm Tara Brabazon, and I'm recording this session today on my iPod, the stark white object that has become the sign of the 2000s. More than the BlackBerry, more than Vanilla Coke, the iPod has captured something about our time. Throughout our session today, we think about the iPod, but we also explore the role of sound in our lives and what happens when we carry our music around with us. We make music mobile. But first, let's talk a little bit about the nature of popular music. Much of the history of music has involved a battle, sometimes between generations or races or ethnic groups, about the boundary between what is music and what is noise. Too often in the 2000s, policymakers have assumed that popular music is part of youth culture. Now, not only is that a generalization, but it's also historically inaccurate. Popular music is much bigger than youth culture, has been throughout much of its history. Broadway and London shows from the 1920s and the 1930s had enormous popular currency. The history of popular music, though, through the 1960s and the 1970s, that was part of the narratives of youth culture. At this time, popular music had a function for young people. For the baby boomer generation, music provided a way to redefine their social environment. Sound occupies space, and when it's combined with dancing and collectivity, forms a way to build an identity of difference. So, from rock and roll to the mid and late 1950s, music was used to confirm the separation of generations, to separate the parents from the kids. So from the mid to late 1950s, age determined what people listened to and how they thought about themselves. But what's happened is that the ideological power of the 1960s and the baby boomers, who were the young people at that time, created a tight link, a tight bond between youth, rock, and resistance. The baby boomers were a large group, and they remained a bulge in the population profile. The generations that followed, Generation X, that's me, and Generation Y and Z, most of you listening, are always playing political catch-up. Because the group in power are baby boomers, as they've aged, they've carried their music with them. This means that musical history before and after the 1960s tends to be underwritten, and this problem has profound consequences for understanding music in our present. Now, the loss of the conventional music charts, the loss of the conventional ways of listening to music, was such a surprise, and they were handled so badly because the music producers assumed that the 1960s and the baby boomer modes of music production and consumption would last forever. It's impossible to understand the iPod as a cultural object and how it transformed music unless we break up that rock youth resistance bundle. In other words, the long 1960s is over. It's very important that we in media studies start to reclaim the many ways that music has been listened to in the last 150 years. Music moves in the spaces between the notes and between the social spaces of our lives. Music links our lives with wider social experiences. Music teaches us what it means to be a man, be a woman, to fall in love. So many of the activities in our lives have a soundtrack. But how much of our lives, how much of your life, is based around movement? We have transportation systems that move our bodies through space. We have communication systems that move our ideas through space, and popular cultural platforms that allow us to take our music wherever we go. But at the same time, our cities are more complex, and with the threat of terrorism, it's simply more difficult to move around our world. Every now and again, like what happened in August this year, a terrorist threat is going to close down our airports. It's going to make it more difficult to get around. Mobility has become a new marker of class and power. Those who have power have the choice to move. Those who lack power are immobile. For those of you who have an interest in globalization, hi there, you can see the link I'm making. The powerful companies, the powerful corporations and individuals are able to move through space. They're able to gain profit from exploiting an immobile labor force and then exporting the goods that they produce around the world. So, new ways of thinking about class-based differences are tethered to mobility and immobility. Mobility is power. Mobility creates choices. Increasingly, our mobilities are punctuated through sound, whether it be through the iPod or the mobile phone. Sound is a very special platform. It's not definitive. It's not a definitive medium like vision. Sound challenges us to reconsider our environment and the relationship with people around us. For example, 80% of complaints in Britain are about neighbours' music. The problem, of course, is not only the neighbours' music, but that the neighbours' music is different from your music. There are extraordinarily volatile and changeable definitions of noise, sound, and music. Different generations, racial and ethnic groups construct different barriers between sound and noise. And that's why mobile sonic platforms, whether the mobile phone or mobile music players, have become part of popular culture so quickly. These platforms construct a safe version of home music that can be recreated wherever we go. What these platforms do is block out other people's noise, which stops us being challenged in our definitions of sound. Music platforms are central to the public acceptance of particular modes of technology. So if a platform can connect mobility and music, then it has a very good chance of being successful. Just as email was the unexpected success story of the internet, so has compression software become the success story of the World Wide Web. And in 1998, the MP3, the Motion Picture Experts Group Audio Layer 3 compression technology, was developed by the Industry Standards Association. What that allowed was a uniform compression for low bandwidth streaming through the internet. MP3 allowed the compression of many more songs to be stored on a compact disc with little loss of quality, but it also allowed the transfer of files over the internet. So Napster file sharing network was launched in 1998, and while it was attacked through analog law, moving digital music over the internet would not be so easily curbed. So with the music industry wedding itself to baby boomer 1960s models for distributing individual songs and albums, they missed the potential for the sale of music over the web as MP3 files. So in this corporate gap, and recognizing the waste of half-filled CDs and the truly ridiculous CD single, the iPod jutted into popularity. So what is the attraction of the iPod and other MP3 players? Well, firstly, they integrate screen and sound through the potential of digitization. There is a great benefit and ease in accessing a personal musical database through a screen. It's facilitated through file compression technology, so it means hours can be spent simply moving through your personal greatest hits. The idea of scrolling through music is very attractive to me. I think a new way of thinking about movement through music is emerging here. As you may know, and I love this, a scroll was the format for print before the book. The scroll existed 3,000 years ago and was stored in famous institutions like the Library of Alexandria. It was a large length of papyrus that was unfurled to reveal knowledge. Now the scroll was then replaced by the book, you know, the paper we're binding, the book that we now take for granted. But every new media carries old media forward with it. I love the fact that we scroll through an iPod. It carries forward a very old and very distinguished way of moving through ideas. Now, I love my iPod. It really does travel everywhere with me. I record interviews with it. I'm recording these sessions for you today with it. I listen to audiobooks. It really is the soundtrack to and for my life. But there are problems with the iPod, and it involves how we think about the self in society. The iPod immerses the listener into a very private world, cut away from the community-building nature of popular music that has existed throughout much of music's history. So the iPod is a personal soundtrack. It also disconnects the listener away from their environment. You have to ask, are there social costs and consequences in being isolated from the world, endlessly immersed in a private greatest hits collection? We have to ask. When we block our ears to hear other music, other sounds, other noises, are we also blocking our brains from thinking about and hearing alternatives?